Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The first rays of spring sunshine parted the thin gray clouds and fell on the man sitting by the smoldering remains of last night's fire. He glanced up, thankful for the light, and brought his attention back to the task at hand. Carefully, precisely pouring gunpowder from an iron flask into the dozen small wooden bottles spread around it. As he finished pouring, he plugged each bottle with a cork stopper and then hooked it onto the leather bandolier across his chest. 12, the man thought, like the 12 apostles. Good luck. He crossed himself, patted his matchlock arquebus firearm, and whispered a prayer for what he was about to receive. The arquebusier's name was Diego. And on the morning of April 24th, 1547, he and around 20,000 of his compatriots were camped near the village of Mühlberg in eastern Germany. Saxony was a long way from home for Diego. He had been born in a dusty village near Burgos in Spain 40 years before, the youngest son of seven in a poor family of cattle herders. He had no land, no money, and no hope for a life of anything other than grinding poverty and hunger. So at the age of 17, Diego had joined the army of Charles V, the King of Spain, Holy Roman Emperor, King of Naples, Count of Flanders, and much else besides. Wherever Charles's interests touched, and that was pretty much everywhere in the Mediterranean and Europe, Diego had traveled in the years since. He had gone pike to pike with French and Swiss at Pavia near Milan, shot Florentines on their very own city walls, gutted an Ottoman janissary in some nameless Greek town, and taken an arrow to the shoulder from a Barbary pirate outside Tunis. Now he was in Germany to kill Protestants for Charles V. Diego itched the patch of scar tissue on his right cheek, shiny layered burns from the constant explosion of gunpowder whenever he pulled the trigger of his arquebus. It was the only place his thick beard, now flecked with more gray than its original black, didn't grow. Horns and drums broke the morning stillness, followed by shouting in Castilian, Hungarian, and German. Orders were coming down. Diego picked up his much-dented helmet off the ground and jammed it onto his head, double-checked his powder charges in their wooden bottles, and grabbed his arquebus. It was time. Time for yet another battle, more death in the name of Charles V. The prospect of killing heretics didn't bother Diego one bit. He shouldered his arquebus, whistled a tune, and joined a marching column of arquebusiers in stride. By 1547, more than 50 years of constant warfare had engulfed Europe and its neighbors, and more than another decade would pass before any sort of general peace prevailed. War changed drastically, as pikes and arquebuses displaced knights on horseback, clouds of freshly discharged gunpowder obscured battlefields, and armies grew into the tens of thousands. Diego came near the end of this long and fundamental transition, but he was hardly unique. Today, we'll explore the lives of two more people, composite characters, to help us understand what these enormous transformations in war meant for the people who experienced them. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Italian Wars defined the politics of the first half of the 16th century. They grew out of deeply medieval dynastic concerns rooted in marriages more than a century old and were initially about control of the Kingdom of Naples and the Duchy of Milan. Yet over decades of constant conflict, they became more about the balance of power in early modern Europe, the delicate and difficult relationship between Habsburg Spain and Valois France. These two were the poles that everything else in European politics revolved around, and remained so until the end of the 30 Years' War a century later. 65 years of war changed the political map. For all intents and purposes, the Italian Wars ended the Italian Renaissance, both by destroying its material basis and diffusing it so far across Europe that it wasn't distinctly Italian anymore. The states of Italy so far ahead of their time in the machinery of government and so crucial to the medieval world, were never again major players in European politics. Part of the reason the European economy's center of gravity moved north toward Germany, the Low Countries, and England from Italy at precisely this time was the simple fact that Italy was a war zone for 6 decades. War itself changed drastically. The scale shot through the roof, with thousands of soldiers turning into tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands under arms. Infantry, with pikes and handguns, finally displaced cavalry as masters of the battlefield. Artillery made fortifications more technically demanding to build and harder to take. All of that was expensive beyond belief, so it required an expansion of the apparatus of government and financing necessary to support it. Only the treasure of the New World offset Spain's enormous expenditures, until even that ran out, and both Spain and France eventually declared bankruptcy. More than any definitive battlefield victory or defeat, financial exhaustion is what finally ended the Italian Wars in 1559. For the last 2 episodes, we've focused on this big, broad scope of the Italian Wars. Emperors, kings, popes, generals, battles and sieges, treaties, all of the standard stuff that forms the backbone of any understanding of a major political event like this. But the Italian Wars were more than a collection of the triumphs and blunders of great men and women. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers marched off to war during that 65-year stretch, everywhere from the bleak moors of Northumbria to the sun-drenched plains of Lombardy and the scorching coast of North Africa. They were the ones who felt the jarring impact of lance on armor, the burning heat of a lit arquebus match, the weight of a pike after 25 miles on the road. Today, we'll try to understand the Italian Wars from their perspective. We'll follow 2 composite characters, people from different places and social classes and times, to see how they transformed war and war transformed them. Let's begin in France, where the ambitions of the young King Charles VIII lit the fuse of 65 years of warfare. We've talked before about how a series of dynastic successions buried deep in the medieval past gave Charles VIII a claim on the Kingdom of Naples, and how he activated that claim in the aftermath of King Ferrante's death in 1494. Really, though, this was about motivation and opportunity. Charles was deeply interested in Italy and wanted to win some glory for himself, rather than righting a centuries-old dynastic wrong. None of that was particularly important to our new friend, or even well-known to him. We'll call him Robert. In 1494, when he rode through the Alps and onto the dusty roads of Italy, Robert was 45 years old and well into middle age. His hair had thinned out, leaving behind a high forehead, and what was left on top of his head was more gray than brown. A profusion of scars marked his face, and he limped a little on a bulky right leg. The trip south with Charles VIII was not his first campaign. Far from it. Most of Robert's life had been spent on campaign or training for it. He was a professional soldier, a gendarme, in the standing army of France. A gendarme, a man-at-arms, was the late medieval descendant of the classic knight, a tank on horseback who wore heavy armor and carried a lance. Far from being obsolete in the closing decade of the 15th century, men-at-arms formed the core of every standing army that existed in Europe at the time. The lance was the basic unit everywhere, essentially a squad with 1 man-at-arms, 1 to 4 archers or other infantry depending on precisely where you were, and squires to handle the horses. Lances didn't fight together. The men-at-arms were off fighting as an armored lance-holding fist, but they were administratively useful. The condottieri of Italy still relied on lances with a man-at-arms at the center. Charles the Bold of Burgundy had built his permanent force on the Italian model. The French had been the first major state north of the Alps to try out a standing army, and they too had built their Compagnie des Ordonnances on armored lancers. By 1494, the Compagnie des Ordonnances, of which Robert was a member, had been around for half a century. They were a product of the closing stages of the Hundred Years' War, the final French victory over the bankrupt and poorly led English. King Charles VII, Charles VIII's grandfather, had suffered through a long period of trouble at the hands of his most powerful vassals before finally pulling it together in the 1430s and 1440s. A standing army meant that he didn't need to rely solely on his dukes and counts for military support, and at the same time, offered a way to bind the lower nobility directly into royal service. This was how Robert's father had come to serve in the Compagnie des Ordonnances before him. He was the second son of a minor noble family in Picardy in northern France, the kind that lived in a broken-down manor house with a filled-in moat and held a few poor villages that had been repeatedly sacked by marauding English. Robert's grandfather had died at the Battle of Verneuil in 1424, leaving them with more pride than money or land even for the eldest, much less the second son. For Robert's father, serving the king directly as a soldier meant a steady wage and more prestige than he was likely to get as the runner-up to a crappy manor. In that capacity, Robert's father was present for the final campaigns in Normandy and Gascony that ended the English occupation in France for good. Robert, born around 1450, as his father was fighting in Normandy, was his father's eldest son. His best opportunity likewise lay in royal service, and he became his father's page at the age of 15 in 1465. Robert got his first taste of war that year, fighting for King Louis XI, the Universal Spider, against Charles the Bold of Burgundy and a profusion of noble allies in the War of the Public Good. He was there at Charles's death at the Battle of Nancy in 1477, on unofficial loan from Louis XI to the Duke of Lorraine. 2 years later, he faced off for the first time with the armies of Maximilian, later the Holy Roman Emperor, at the Battle of Ginegat. He lost his favorite horse to the pike of a German Lanzknecht mercenary, and the fall gave him a lifelong limp before the age of 30. A few more campaigns followed in the 1480s, including a civil war and another against Maximilian. Robert married, had children of his own, and acquired a small manor house at a bargain price from a cousin. There was real status associated with being a permanent member of a Compagnie des Ordonnances. The high nobility squabbled and competed to lead the individual companies, so Robert had access to some of the most powerful lords in France because of his service. In his case, his commander and patron was Pierre, Duke of Bourbon, one of King Charles VIII's closest associates. Even if the Duke was old and increasingly unable to lead his company in person, Robert was surrounded by members of the middling and high nobility of France. Because of his increasing prosperity and his connections, Robert was able to afford a brand new set of the finest imported armor on the eve of Charles's Italian campaign in 1494. That armor was at the core of what made a gendarme, and men-at-arms more generally, continually viable even as war was changing dramatically. I mentioned before that the Compagnie des Ordonnances had come into existence at the end of the Hundred Years' War. But wait, you say, hadn't English longbows repeatedly defeated French men-at-arms on the battlefield over the course of that conflict? Why would you build your standing army around armored lancers and not archers? Well, partially because there wasn't a pool of trained archers in France to draw on, as there was in England, and the French attempts to build one were somewhere between a joke and an abject, ridiculous failure. Partially because binding the nobility, who wanted to fight in armor on horseback, to the king was part of the point of the standing army. But finally, it was also because armor was just more effective in the later 15th century than it had been earlier. Full suits of steel plate, shaped to deflect incoming blows and topped with a visored helmet, had become the norm. Forges in Milan, Brescia, Augsburg, and Nuremberg, and imitators elsewhere in Europe, turned out exceptionally strong and lightweight armor. Nothing was 100%, of course, but arrows from longbows, crossbow bolts, and even arquebus shots could bounce right off. And everything from head to toe was covered in that layer of steel plate. Their horses wore armor, too, usually a combination of steel and boiled, hardened leather under thick padding. The horses were a little more vulnerable, but nowhere close to the large, inviting targets they'd been for English longbowmen in the Hundred Years' War. When you put the weight of a fully armored and well-trained man on a galloping horse behind a sharp lance, the result was still devastating. Nobody wanted to be on the receiving end of a charge from French gendarmes like Robert and his comrades, especially because they trained together regularly and had a good idea of what they were doing. These were well-paid professional soldiers, many of them, like Robert, with decades of experience on the cutting edge of war. Robert wasn't even the oldest. He knew a gendarme named Martinet Baron, who had served Charles the Bold of Burgundy in the 1460s, then Louis XI, and then Charles VIII after him. He spent his life as a gendarme, and he died a gendarme at a siege in 1503, serving one final king, Louis XII. French chivalry had been famous for centuries, and the gendarmes embodied that even as the 16th century approached. As 1494 dawned and King Charles VIII began to plan his Italian campaign in earnest, Robert and his compagnie traveled south to the city of Lyon, where the French army was assembling before heading on to Italy. the king himself arrived in April, and before long, there were French troops in Genoa. It took a little while for things to get off the ground, but by the beginning of August, Robert felt the breath of the Alpine breeze as he climbed up toward the mountain passes that led down into Italy. He and his company were close to the king himself, an incredible honor. Even if Robert's joints creaked and his back ached from the strain of day after day on horseback and foot, the promise of glory around the corner drove him on. This was war as his father and grandfather understood it, a chivalric quest for honor and reputation in sight of the king. Like the armored man-at-arms himself, there was nothing anachronistic or outmoded about chivalry in 1494. It was a deeply embedded part of the mood and worldview that shaped and drove Robert and his companions, and King Charles himself for that matter. Robert had heard the tales of King Arthur and his knights, the deeds of his knightly ancestors, and imbibed the importance of honor and prowess from early childhood. So had all his companions in the Compagnie des Ordonnances. The gendarmes, all of them people with this background and outlook, were an integral part of the king's cutting-edge army with its big blocks of mercenary Swiss pikemen and its long artillery train. The latter are the ones that usually get the attention about the changing face of war at the dawn of the modern era, but Robert's day was far from done. The heat of the Italian September cooled into the chill of October and November, and then the rainy, unpleasant December, as the army worked its way south into Tuscany and Lazio. Robert saw the skeletal remains of Roman aqueducts framed against the steel-gray winter sky, felt the cobbles of ancient roads underneath his feet, and caught glimpses of the new Renaissance architecture of Italy in Florence's Duomo. A couple of sieges ended in brutal sacks, but that was business for the artillery and the infantry, not him. Naples, the campaign's goal, loomed ahead through January and February. The city fell without a fight. And like King Charles, Robert didn't even have to wear his armor when he entered Naples. But there was trouble on the horizon. Robert heard whispers from the high lords in the army that powers were gathering an alliance against them. Milan, Venice, perhaps even the Holy Roman Emperor and the King of Aragon. But that was above his pay grade, and he whiled away the late winter and spring with gambling and drinking in camp in the taverns of Naples. Some of his comrades paid for the time of Naples courtesans and picked up a vicious case of venereal disease for their trouble. After a few months of that, Robert wasn't surprised when the order came to pull out and head back north with the king. There was a small Spanish army wintering in Sicily that was preparing to invade Naples from the south, he'd heard, and an Italian force blocking their line of retreat back to France. It was now or never, and Robert was glad not to be left with the French force that stayed behind in Naples. Most of the march north was uneventful until the hot, humid morning of July 6, 1494. It had rained overnight, and Robert's knees and back ached as his squire pulled on his heavy suit of plate armor before dawn. First light was just peeking over the hills around the River Taro as he hefted his lance, spurring his horse to join the group of gendarmes surrounding King Charles as they marched further down the road. They knew the Italians were close. In all likelihood, there would be a battle today.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The sun rose behind the slopes to the east, hidden behind a bank of threatening clouds. There was just enough light to see the outlines of the Italian camp in the distance to their right beyond the river, and closer in the foreground, columns full of armored men-at-arms on horseback trying to ford the swollen waters. The sounds of fighting, of steel clashing on steel, were coming from up ahead on the road. Robert couldn't see what was happening at the front of the column, but it wasn't his business. Staying close to the king was. The orders went up, trumpets blaring, drums beating, visors closing down with a clank, lances settling into their rests under the arm, armor plates banging against one another, horses neighing and pawing at the ground. The Italian men-at-arms were bunched up, soaking wet, as they tried to assemble on this side of the river. Robert and the gendarmes formed up and waited until the word came. Charge. Slowly at first, weighed down by their riders and armor, the horses worked into a trot, then a slow gallop. The ground was muddy and cloying from the overnight rain. It sucked at the horses' hooves as they ran and slowed them down. The Italians were trying to get themselves into a line to meet the charge with some momentum of their own, but too slow. The massive figures resolved into individuals as Robert and his comrades got closer. The gendarme picked out a target, a thick-set man wearing a helmet with a T-shaped opening, and leveled his lance. 50 feet, 25, 10, in the blink of an eye. Robert could see the surprise and fear in the man's eyes as he tried to spur his horse toward the oncoming French and ready himself. Too late. There was a tremendous crash as his lance hit on the man's breastplate, throwing him from the horse and nearly tearing Robert's shoulder to shreds with the force of the impact. It was a miracle his lance hadn't shattered. The sound of splintering wood, steel crashing on steel, screaming horses, and dying men filled the air as the French careened into the Italians. It was chaos. Robert stabbed and stabbed with his lance until it broke, then pulled his sword and hacked away at the Italians. The blade rang on the fine, curving surface of his enemy's Italian-made armor, struggling to find openings. There were too many of them, he thought, and he could see a group of Italian men-at-arms closing in on the king and his immediate guards. He spurred his horse and drove it through the ruck of the melee, coming up behind an Italian who was leveling his sword at the king and found a gap in the man's armor for the tip of his blade. Through the slit in his visor, he caught a glimpse of a sword in the hand of an Italian swinging toward his head. There was no time to do anything but take the blow. A tremendous clang rang in his ears, his neck twisted painfully with the force of it as he tried to keep his head upright, and the steel of his helmet bent under the impact. But he was still alive. The swordsman fell, knocked off his horse by another one of the French. The humidity was murderous. Robert could feel sweat pouring from his armpits and his forehead. He was gasping for breath inside his twisted, bent helmet. His right arm and shoulder ached fiercely despite the adrenaline coursing through his veins. How long had he been fighting? A minute? 10? An hour? With the king safe, Robert and the French men-at-arms pulled back, leaving a mass of bodies, men and horses both, lying on the ground behind them. Everywhere he could see the French breaking off, the sounds of battle diminishing. His head rang and his shoulder was in agony. Something had torn when his lance hit the Italian at the very start of the battle. The king raised the visor of his helmet and gestured to Robert, thanking him for his assistance, and promised him a reward. The gendarme swelled with pride. He had always dreamt of a moment like this. The French army continued north. It had lost its baggage, but escaped mostly intact. The Italians proclaimed a great victory, but they had the worst of the fight. Robert's shoulder and arm were ruined. This would be his last campaign, he realized when he returned to France. It was time to retire, to leave behind the Compagnie des Ordonnances and the life of a gendarme. But he was well known for his actions at the Battle of Fornovo, and he had a small estate, and perhaps his son would follow another French king into war in the future. In many ways, Robert was a throwback to a bygone age. His grandfather had died in the Hundred Years' War, his father had fought in its closing stages, and Robert himself had gotten his start in a firmly medieval series of conflicts. He imbibed knightly virtue from childhood, he wore a full suit of armor, and he fought on horseback. But men-at-arms still had a place on the battlefields of the Italian Wars, just as they had for centuries. There was a good reason gendarmes formed the core of Charles VIII's army. They decided the Battle of Fornovo, just as they crushed the newly arrived Spanish infantry, veterans of the long war against the Moors of Granada, at the Battle of Seminara the week before. Chivalry, like Robert, was not dead yet. Men-at-arms, particularly the French ones, always had a whiff of the aristocracy about them. Even the professional condottieri of Italy usually came from well-off families. But most of the soldiers who fought in the Italian Wars were of more common vintage, foot soldiers without a drop of noble blood. They, not gendarmes like Robert, were responsible for the drastic changes in war that went along with this period. One of the defining shifts of this time was the increasing importance of infantry. A hedgehog pike formation like that of the redoubtable Swiss could hold men-at-arms like Robert at bay and blow through more lightly armed infantry like a steamroller. There was a good reason Charles VIII and every other French king paid for the services of the Swiss whenever they could throughout the Italian Wars. They were necessary and effective. Arquebusiers with their gunpowder handguns were proving their effectiveness in sieges and on the battlefield. Infantry was also much cheaper than men-at-arms, so the need to field larger armies as wars got longer and more complex and had more fronts naturally gave foot soldiers more emphasis numbers-wise. The Swiss, as I mentioned, were one major source of well-trained, disciplined, effective infantry. The other, the great rivals of the Swiss, were the mercenary pikemen of Germany, the Landsknechts. Let's meet one of them. We'll call him Paul and say he was born around 1485 in southern Germany, Augsburg to be precise. His father was a weaver, one of thousands who worked in the booming cloth industry of the region. As we talked about back in our episode on Jakob Fugger, the cloth trade, bringing in raw wool and cotton, producing cloth, and then exporting it in huge quantities all across Europe, was the root of southern Germany's commercial vitality. In its small and prosperous way, Paul's family was a key cog in that industry. Five children, of whom Paul was the third, crowded into their half-timbered Augsburg home. His elder brother was apprenticed to one of Augsburg's middling cloth merchants to learn the next rung up in the trade, and his sister had married the son of a prominent goldsmith. Paul would carry on the weaving, his father thought, taking on some employees and building a larger business with his elder brother. It was a respectable path to upward mobility, the kind of path countless families had taken in an increasingly prosperous South Germany over the past 150 years. As he grew into an adolescent, Paul had no interest in that. He hated weaving and had a wild streak a mile wide. Wrestling, brawling, and drinking in Augsburg's taverns was what he wanted to do, not sit in a workshop weaving fustian. Paul's father threatened to throw him out of the house, whipped him to try to make him work, and finally threw up his hands in despair. It wasn't fitting for a boy from a good family to act that way, he said. Paul would shame them all, bring dishonor, bankrupt them in a lawsuit, and ruin their prospects. Luckily for both Paul and his troubled home life, there was a solution. Paul's uncle Hans, his mother's youngest brother, had been a similarly wild youth before he found his calling, mercenary work. Hans had first shouldered a pike as a teenager and discovered that the life of a Landsknecht suited him. He had fought in the Low Countries and in Switzerland. The Emperor Maximilian himself had praised his courage. In 1504, when Paul was 20 years old, Hans was just returning from a campaign all the way to the north in Sweden. The Landsknecht rolled into Augsburg with his flat, feathered cap tilted at a rakish angle above a face sporting a fresh pink band of scar tissue across the nose. Bright stripes of blue and red ran across his shirt and pants. Hans swaggered into Augsburg with a whiff of adventure and testosterone, and that was more than enough of an inducement for a youth who had no reason to stay home any longer. Did he want to come along on the next campaign, Hans asked. Of course, Paul replied. Paul's father took him to one of many Augsburg's many armorer's shops and bought him a pike, a Landsknecht's short sword called a Katzbalger, a cat gutter, and a cheap breastplate that didn't fit him particularly well. With that, Paul was off.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
There was a war on the way, and close to home, over the succession to one of the duchies of Bavaria. Wars needed soldiers, and Hans and his nephew were prime candidates. It was a short conflict, without major battles, but long enough for Paul to get a feel for his weapons, see a knight lose a hand to a cannonball, and decide that the life of a soldier was the right path for him. For the next few years, Paul bounced from campaign to campaign. He spent a little while in Bohemia, then did a stint in Saxony, fought in some small-scale feuds between nobles and Franconia, and finally came back toward Augsburg in 1509 when he heard that the war in Italy was back on and the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian was hiring. He and Uncle Hans looked for a recruiter. They found one in a minor Tyrolean nobleman by the name of Georg von Frundsberg, a thick-set, broad-shouldered, bearded man in his early 30s. Von Frundsberg had already been around the block more than a few times by 1509. Uncle Hans knew him from the Swiss War a decade earlier, and Paul had seen him in action in the Bavarian War of 1504. Since then, von Frundsberg had grown into one of the premier Landsknecht captains in business. And it was a business, both for von Frundsberg and common soldiers like Paul and Hans. Now, there had always been soldiers selling their skills for money. The medieval idea of the knight doing occasional short-term military service in return for land had never been more than a part of the story, even at its peak, which was centuries past by 1500. The English armies of the Hundred Years' War had all fought on contract. The Wars of the Roses were fought by paid retainers. We covered the condottieri of Italy here a couple of months ago, and they were all money-grubbing soldiers of fortune. Mercenary service of various kinds had been common in Germany for a long time, including mercenary knights on long-term contracts and captains who recruited foot soldiers. The Landsknechts, mercenaries all, first appeared as a German response to the Swiss pikemen who brought down Charles the Bold in 1477. In other words, the basic structures of war as business were already in place by the time the Italian Wars began. There were local and regional markets for mercenaries that functioned much like the markets for any other kind of good or service. But the immediate increase in the scale of conflict that went along with the Italian Wars helped to produce a thriving international market in mercenaries. We've already seen how Charles VIII recruited a whole bunch of Swiss pikemen in 1494. Maximilian brought Landsknechts to Italy in 1496. And the Duke of Milan hired a bunch of Germans in 1499. By 1509, when von Frundsberg hung up his shield outside a Bavarian tavern and signed up enthusiastic recruits like Paul and Uncle Hans, business was booming. Pike infantry like Landsknechts filled a necessary niche in the evolving landscape of warfare. Formed up into large, dense squares, many ranks deep, pikes turned the formation into a steamrolling hedgehog. They could hold off charging men-at-arms, even the big hosses like our friend Robert, because no horse was going to willingly impale itself on sharp pikes for fun. The sheer weight of the formation meant that more lightly armed infantry, like Spanish swordsmen, weren't going to hold them up if they were rolling forward. The problem was that that took training, discipline, and raw courage to maintain a pike square in the heat of battle. It just wasn't possible for amateur part-timers to keep their cool and their formation with guns blazing and knights charging. Those guys just broke and ran, something that happened time and again on battlefields all over Europe between the 1470s and the 1500s. If you wanted to win a battle in the late 15th or the early 16th century, you needed large numbers of professionals who knew their way around a pike. That was where the international mercenary market came in. So Uncle Hans and Paul joined up with von Frundsberg and headed south into the Tyrol, then over the Alps to northern Italy. Paul caught his first glimpse of Maximilian, the emperor's stocky, powerful frame contained inside a suit of the finest Augsburg plate armor. The campaign against Venice wasn't particularly eventful, with a series of sieges and a great deal of marching across northern Italy. Paul's feet got a workout, and he wore through a couple of pairs of shoes. He also got his first taste of the inconsistent pay that the emperor so often offered his troops. It took a subsidy from the King of France, with whom Maximilian was allied, to get Paul and Uncle Hans and the rest of the Lanzknechts paid in 1509. That money only lasted so long, though. As 1509 dragged into 1510 and then 1511, the rest of the pay didn't show up. Paul was mutinous, and so were his comrades. The war dragged to a halt, and they essentially refused to leave Verona, their base of operations, without the money they'd been promised. As far as Paul and his comrades were concerned, their contract was through. As the new year of 1512 dawned, Paul had been in Italy for more than 2 years. His flashy, striped clothing was threadbare. He couldn't afford a new pair of shoes to replace the worn-down ones he was wearing. The people of Verona were sick of him and his fellow Lanzknechts for good reason. It was time to get out. When a messenger arrived from Milan, a Frenchman offering excellent pay for an upcoming campaign against Venice, Paul and Uncle Hans and a few thousand more of their unpaid friends set off to join the French army of Gaston de Foix. From Paul's perspective, he and his compatriots weren't doing anything wrong. Their overlord, the Emperor Maximilian, was allied to the French. They hadn't been paid in months. They didn't owe anything to somebody who wasn't paying them anyway. De Foix was headed for the city of Brescia, a rich industrial center famous for its weapons and armor. Paul and several thousand of his Lanzknecht companions met the French army as it traveled along the muddy winter roads of Lombardy. Brescia had revolted against French rule some months before. De Foix intended to teach its inhabitants a lesson about what loyalty to the King of France really meant. De Foix was barely out of his teens, bursting with energy and showing a political sense for ruthlessness far beyond his years. He personally led Paul, a few thousand Lanzknechts, and some dismounted men-at-arms in an attack on the walls. Paul felt the wind of passing arquebus balls and crossbow bolts, dodged roof tiles and stones thrown by women and children, and narrowly avoided being scalded by boiling water. Because Brescia had rejected a demand to surrender, it was open season. De Foix gave his troops a free hand to sack the city, and the result was an orgy of violence and plunder. For 3 days, Paul and his compatriots murdered civilians in the streets by the thousand and gathered up valuables worth millions of ducats. Paul and his uncle, along with a group of other mercenaries, went after a church. Paul managed to grab a hold of a gold cross and some silver plate, while Uncle Hans took a bejeweled reliquary and dumped out the bones of the saint to make room for some coin. The priest was already dead when they got there, gutted in front of the altar, and so were a few civilians who'd tried to take shelter. They were images Paul would never forget, even though he told himself that the sack had been perfectly legal according to the laws of war. De Foix told the Marquis of Mantua that they had taken the city, quote, with God's favor for a just cause, thanks to its rebellion against its rightful overlord, the King of France. The campaign was far from over. From Brescia, De Foix took them east toward Milan, then back west again into the Romagna. Their target was the city of Ravenna, the key supply base for the Spanish and papal army threatening French interests in northern Italy. By early April, tired and hungry and worn out from months of marching back and forth across Lombardy, weighed down by the plunder they'd taken in Brescia, Paul and the rest of the army arrived near Ravenna. April 11th was Easter Sunday. Paul hadn't attended Mass in months. Every time he thought about it, he saw the dead priest in Brescia in his mind's eye. His sins weighed on him. That was what was on his mind as he formed up in a large block along with the rest of the Lanzknechts. Paul was in the front rank, his Uncle Hans next to him. He hadn't been in the front rank at the beginning of their march. A Spanish cannonball had blasted through 3 men ahead of him, pushing him up a few spots. The guns had been firing for what seemed like hours. The Frenchman over to his right had gotten the worst of it, but he'd seen more than a few cannon shots slam into the lanzknechts as well. His pike weighed heavily in his hands. The fear rose from his stomach into his chest. He thought he might vomit. The smell of freshly released urine was coming from somewhere near him, barely detectable under the sulfurous stench of gunpowder and the reek of unwashed bodies. In the distance, through the swirling clouds of white smoke and the haze of a warm April morning, Paul could see a ditch and piled up earth behind it. Beyond the embankment was a line of carts, and he could just make out small figures along the line of the trench and the wagons. It looked like they held arquebuses, gunpowder handguns. Spaniards, he thought, judging by the banners that sometimes appeared above the smoke. If he squinted, he thought he could see the smoldering glow of the lit matches that would touch off the arquebus's gunpowder when the users pulled the trigger. The pounding of his heart rang in Paul's ears, almost drowning out the thud of marching feet as the lanzknechts got closer and closer, trotting as quickly as they could while maintaining their formation. 300 yards, 200, 100. He could make out the face of an arquebusier in front of him, bearded and squinting, sighting down the barrel of his weapon. It looked like it was aimed straight at him. The opening at the end looked as big as a cannon. There was a shout in Spanish, and then the whole world exploded in gunfire. He felt the heat and wind of arquebus balls passing, heard the screams rising to his left and right. A great cloud of white smoke obscured the ditch and carts ahead. As one, the pike formation picked up its pace. They were nearly to the ditch now. The arquebusiers couldn't miss. Paul felt a sudden pain on the left side of his head as a ball ripped away his earlobe. He was luckier than some others who fell wounded or dead to be trampled by their onrushing comrades. The ditch wasn't too deep, but it was enough to slow the lanzknechts and break their pike square. Paul jumped down, felt a shock in his legs as he landed, nearly dropping the pike. He tried to clamber up, slipped, tried again. The arquebuses were still firing. Crack, 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 the billowing clouds of white smoke making it hard to see anything. Uncle Hans made it to the top of the ditch next to him, then fell back. Paul tried to pull him to his feet, but there was a cavernous hole in his forehead where an arquebus shot had landed. He saw an arquebusier above him on the lip of the trench, desperately trying to pour powder down the barrel of his gun. He stabbed upward and impaled him on the sharp point of his pike. More Spaniards appeared at the top of the trench, stray rays of sunlight breaking through the smoke and flashing off their helmets, small round shields, and the blades of their swords. They leapt down into the trench and charged toward the lanzknechts. Paul drew back his pike and stabbed, catching one in the throat, but the next man slipped past his spear point and forced him backwards. The lanzknechts were packed in tight. Paul could feel his shoulders pressed against the men on either side and felt the men behind pushing him forward right into the oncoming enemy. The Spaniard was on him now. He saw the point of the man's sword coming toward him, felt the impact as it glanced off the cheap steel breastplate his father had bought him so many years before. The man's sword drew back again, thrust aimed at his unarmored legs, and he felt searing pain as the edge of the blade grazed the outside of his thigh. His pike was too long to hit the Spaniard. He was stuck with so many lanzknechts around him. The adrenaline pumping through his veins was almost overwhelming. Time slowed. Sunlight flashed off the Spaniard's blade. He could see the flattened nose broken several times and the missing teeth in his open, snarling mouth. He even thought he could smell sour wine and just a hint of vomit. Drop the pike or die, Paul realized. He let the wooden shaft fall to the ground and pulled out his short sword. Just in time, he managed to pull it up and parry the Spaniard's longer blade as it stabbed toward his eyes. The man ducked down and lunged forward again. Paul grabbed him by the collar of his shirt and pulled him close, drew back his short sword, and plunged it into the Spaniard's unarmored torso once, twice, three times. But there was another Spaniard behind him and more to the sides. Lanzknechts fell to the floor of the trench with daggers and swords in their bellies and legs, cut down with no room to use their pikes or retreat. Paul was desperately trying to find his footing. The ground underneath him was equal parts bodies, some of them still alive and gasping for breath, and churned earth. Trying to avoid another Spaniard's dagger thrust, Paul tripped and fell. He saw a sword coming for his head and twisted to avoid it. The blade never landed, its holder spitted on a pike held by a man a few rows behind him. Another fell on top of him, weaponless, trying to bite at his face while Paul strangled him with his bare hands. A blade from above plunged through the Spaniard's back and Paul kicked him off, lifeless. A prayer of thanks escaped his lips and he got back to his feet. On and on this went, more Spaniards jumping down into the trench from above, stabbing, falling, getting back up. Finally, the last Spaniards turned and clambered back up out of the trench, leaving the lanzknechts behind. Paul had lost his short sword some time ago and realized he had only a broken dagger in his hand. He dropped it and picked up a pike. His arms and shoulders were exhausted. Breath came only in ragged gasps. Blood oozed from a dozen different spots on his face and arms and legs. With one final effort, less on command than instinct, the lanzknecht moved forward, up and out of the trench. Paul let the others overtake him once he'd reached the top and looked back down. The ditch was full of bodies, literally full. Only here and there could he pick out little patches of earth in between. The sounds of battle were dying down. The incessant crack of arquebuses and the booming of cannon had mostly ceased. Paul fell to his knees and thanked God that he'd survived. Uncle Hans would have laughed at that, he thought, but as far as he was concerned, only divine grace had allowed him to make it through that slaughter. Those images would remain with him for the rest of his life, whether he lived another day or half a century. Contemporaries noted the sheer vicious savagery of the Battle of Ravenna with alarm. But it was the norm moving forward, not an exception. Paul and his fellow lanzknechts had seen the emerging face of war. Arquebuses, artillery barrages, and most horrifying of all, masses of infantry meeting in extended, face-to-face encounters. Bad war, the Italians called it, and it was the direct result of gunpowder, professionalism, and the drastically increased scale of war. Robert's clash with the Italians at Novara in 1495 had been a nearly medieval battle, with men-at-arms on horseback meeting in a thunderous charge. Paul's experience at Ravenna in 1512 would not have been unfamiliar to a soldier of the Thirty Years' War more than a century later. Our friend Diego, whom we met all the way back at the beginning, was the product of more than 50 years of that continuous violence. War had changed forever. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be leaving the Italian Wars behind, but staying in Italy for one more episode. We've talked a lot about Venice, La Serenissima Repubblica, and it's time we focused on the city and its maritime, commercial empire for a full episode. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides, or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.